again, caught pretending not to realize that he's on camera. Yeah. Oh, you don't care, right?
I don't care.
Okay. Hi, I'm Steve Gilmore. This is the Gilmore Gang for Friday in 2017.
December.
I'd like to welcome a returning gangster who I haven't seen for quite a while. He's at his mysterious, undisclosed location in the Pacific Northwest, sort of. And that's Dan Farber. Welcome, Dan.
Good to be with you, Steve. Thanks for inviting me back.
Well, I've invited you back quite a while, but thanks for accepting.
Well, I thank you for inviting me and then accepting that I can return to the program.
Isn't this entertaining?
I believe so. I'm waiting for you to get to the content.
Okay. All right. Well, while I introduce the others, would you think of some content?
Sure.
Okay, excellent.
I'll give it a thought.
All right, yeah. In London, England, above the clouds, as it were, is the guy with the guitar in the back, and that's Frank Raddus.
Hello, Steve. Hello, gangsters.
To his left, actually, his right, our left, that, thank you, in Palo Alto, I believe, is Keith Teer.
Yeah, it's nice to be back in Palo Alto, seeing my family.
And below him, is there, you have to sit up straight, Dennis.
Are those the new rules?
Well, I just wanted to, rather than move the camera, I thought I'd move you. That's
okay.
Perfect. Dennis Pombriant, welcome, Dennis.
It's a pleasure to be here, Steve. Thanks so much for having me. It's Friday afternoon. I'm getting comfortable.
Okay, well, so Dan Farber, what's going on?
Well, that's a very open-ended question. I was hoping as the host of the show, would be the one with the questions.
Oh, well, we're all co-hosts here. And here, and here. I'm doing a Firesign Theater quote.
We're all hosts on this bus.
No, there was, it's from the movie, at the garage, and Phil Austin is singing a song. It's on this new DVD that I'll hawk in just a minute. So, I guess we'll have to talk about Trump, since nobody really wants to. So, I'm excited about the realization on the part of the country that... as he said the other day, that he's in this for 7 years. He was talking to the December 7th guys from Pearl Harbor, and he indicated that he was going to be around for at least another 7 years, and he hoped that they were too.
He can keep his teeth in his mouth.
Ooh, so, I was waiting for the first teeth.
Oh!
Yeah. Right, you get 10 points.
Well, I think that we have to start to realize that he's a serious politician and that he's pretty good at it. Anybody want to argue with me about it?
So is Nixon, Steve. You're about to say he's a good politician and we got to get used to it because he's not going to leave. But Nixon was better and Nixon went.
I would also suggest he's not a politician. He's an oligarch.
I agree.
What is oligarch
actually?
Politicians can tend to try to accomplish things. He has accomplished things strictly for his base. So I would just call that someone who is more in the vein of an oligarch.
And can you describe what oligarch means? I mean, I hear it in the context of Russian billionaires, but what does it actually mean?
Well, you could equate it with the notion of a king or an authoritarian, someone who believes that they have a kind of divine right to rule and do not follow a rule of law necessarily.
A ruler who is the law unto himself.
Thank you for that dictionary.
That's a dictator. An oligarchy is a group, not an individual.
Well,
yeah, but who runs the oligarchy?
I characterize it as the Trump Organization is now taking over the U.S. government. How that turns out, we don't know.
Well, you could say the American people have taken over the U.S. government from the oligarchy, just to stir things up a bit. We had an oligarchy before.
In order to stir things up, you have to actually make sense. I don't understand what you just said.
Well,
in what way have
the guy won an election using the rules as they existed at the time, based on being popular.
That's true for every president. The rules at the time. So
that is true.
Okay,
that is true.
So what are you actually saying?
And so to characterize it as an oligarchy is separating him from the facts. The facts are he was elected.
I think that I'll agree to that. But I would stipulate, Your Honor, that while he was fairly elected with a little help from his friends or whatever, let's ignore that, that now that he is in office, he is running it like an oligarchy as opposed to a democracy.
Well, perhaps the word autocrat would be better.
Yes.
Not to split hairs, but lots of autocrats get democratically elected and then extinguish the democracy. That's really what we're concerned about.
I actually thought, the idea that you posited earlier about the oligarchy being the family and he being the leader of the oligarchy, I've been thinking a lot about this this situation with naming Jerusalem as the capital and how that plays into having his son-in-law supposedly trying to broker peace in the Middle East between the Israelis and the Palestinians while he throws this hand grenade in the middle of this entire process. So that's autocratic because he's like leaving his son-in-law out of the picture in that instance. Apparently even he recommended that he not do that. And I think the Washington Post today wrote a story that where he basically said the same thing he said about healthcare. Oh, this is pretty complicated.
Yes. No argument there.
So what has this got to do with tech, says Simon B.
Wow, you brought it up.
I just work here. I have no. I'm not in charge and never have been.
So I think that the autocratic theme goes back to Obama, who used executive privilege a lot. And it is true, but it isn't unique to Trump. So I think we've got to criticize Trump for the substance of his decisions, for example, making Jerusalem the capital of Israel in American policy, not so much stealing things or being illegitimate. Because people support him because of what he does.
Sorry, I couldn't hear that. Did you say something, Frank, or was it Dennis?
No, that was Dennis.
Sorry. Could you repeat what you said?
I was just saying to Keith, we don't have the data yet to prove that Trump stole anything, such as an election, or that he had criminal assistance from an outside nation, although the work is ongoing.
It seems that trying to drag this somewhat back into the tech arena, and I'll do that by talking about television and the media. It seems that there's a concerted effort underway to try and move Mueller out of the picture.
Well, Fox is certainly trying to do that, and
I think the Republican Party is trying to do that too.
Well, I agree, but I mean, if you're talking about the influence that a single media may have on this individual president, if in fact his main point of reference in terms of gathering data is Fox News, Fox News has been, you know, it's crazy how completely against everything that Mueller does and has to do. It's the only network that's out there making all of this Mueller's got to go noise. And if that's what he's watching and he's hearing those stories, that's what he's repeating in his tweets and in his interviews.
That, you know, that's a kind of a parochial attitude that somehow that the media isn't speaking with one voice, which I think they are. I think they're all selling the same idea, which is that the story that's brewing is that Mueller is under attack and that somehow he's going to be minimized so that if he does deliver indictments or any kind of effective attack on the family and thereby the president, that somehow he's going to be vulnerable to being marginalized.
Look, this is how Trump does business, okay? There's nothing surprising here. This is how he's worked in the business world now that he's the president of the United States. This is how he operates. He tries to get everybody to be loyal to him, to be on his side. And so far, many of the Republicans feel like, you know, that they need to please their donors and so on. There are, you know, if we can bring it back to tech a little bit, there are many issues, of course, besides net neutrality. And one of them is taxing graduate students.
Mm-hmm. So, well, in other words, the people that traditionally don't vote, his non-base, they're attacking financially with the tax reform.
There's a proposal that graduate students would pay taxes on their tuition.
There's also an attack on California by eliminating the deductions for very, very high state taxes. California, New York. In other words, all the important blue states are being attacked through this bill.
True.
Well, a bill which, by the way, had a $3 billion, $380 billion error, which means it's probably going to have to go back to conference anyway.
Well, that might be good news that it has to go back to conference.
Well, if the people speak loudly enough, it may be good news.
So, Dan, your point about the educational, writing down educational costs as a strategy to eliminate the blue states. I'm characterizing it that way.
I look at it a little bit differently. Yes, there's a lot of partisanship going on, but it's also to the degree that for the U.S. to remain competitive and be a center of technology innovation, you know, you need these graduate students to be able to have their educations and not be worried about how are they going to pay their taxes when they're, you know, trying to become contributors to the tax base through their education.
So how do you combat this? I mean, is there nobody that can have any kind of effect on this situation from the point of view that you're suggesting?
Well, there's certainly been some outcry from academia and the tech sector, but it's muted because there's so much other noise in the system right now. I mean, the tax bill even includes like taking away a $250 deduction for teachers who buy pencils and chalk and other things for their students because their budgets don't have enough money to cover those costs.
And now the education secretary is pushing the evangelical schools to take the vouchers I wonder if this speaks to the sort of anti-tech position that it seems as though this administration has. I mean, whatever happened to that large board of technical advisors? What happened to that large board of business advisors? Some of those boards still exist, even though some people quit. But Are they even having meetings? And if they are having meetings, is there anything happening with them? And what, does that just feels like there's an anti-tech, you know, he's a pro-business guy, but he's not meeting with these business leaders. He says he's pro-tech and he wants to be on the at the leading edge, his use of Twitter, blah, blah, blah. But we're not hearing anything from the tech leaders.
Yeah, that's very dangerous because it kind of reminds me of the beginning of the Middle Ages when Roman administration did some stupid things and it resulted in basically a 1,000-year depression.
So what are we we're talking about the decline and fall of this, quote, civilization. And on the other hand, Keith, you've got everybody going crazy about Bitcoin and blockchain. So is that the response of the tech community to having absolutely no leadership in the area that Dan's talking about? Or is there a connection between those two things?
Well, for me, there's a connection. It's optimism and pessimism. Pessimism is everything to do with politics and national governments. And optimism is everything to do with technology and globalization. However, the governments and the politicians will do everything in their power to stop globalization because it erodes their power in the same way that TCPIP eroded the power of the telephone companies.
How is it eroding their power when they have no power?
Well, they have state power. They have tax collection, armies, air forces, navies, policemen. You know, the state is very powerful. But the trend in society is away from it being able to exercise that power over more and more of what previously used to be its domain. And the latest is money. If you can't exercise control over money or communications, then, you know, more and more governments are becoming neutered, but they still have, you know, lawmaking power that can screw everything up.
Can I ask a question?
That supports my point about medievalism. I mean, that's a path down to medievalism. I think the real answer about technology isn't necessarily Bitcoin or blockchain, but everything to do with sustainability. And I know most of you already know my position on that, but it's pretty clear to me that the next big tech move is going to be placed on the shoulders of the information and telecommunications age that we're ending now, and it's going to have to do with making better ways to make renewable electricity, bring forth electric-based transportation. 2019, I just wrote a piece saying that 2019 is going to be a big year for introductions of electric cars. Other technology that we desperately need is good, cheap, highly productive ways to make fresh water out of seawater. We don't have enough water right now, and the population continues to grow. Those kinds of things are what's going to, I think, drive the economy in the decades ahead. And it's all predicated on getting it right with the tech sector of today, IoT, for example.
For me, Dennis, sustainability is great, but I think it also needs a broader definition, which is those things which map most closely to human behavior are likely to be sustainable. In other words, humans are the dominant animal on the planet. We make plans and we execute them badly and well, depending on what the plans are and who's executing them. And right now, I think we're in this era of the global citizen is one way you could think of it, but people like many of us who spend a lot of our time traveling and engaging with other people in all kinds of parts of the world, and both the internet and the blockchain represent, if you like, infrastructure underpinnings to that global reality. And so, to me, sustainability is things which enhance the globalization of the human race and move away from the past. And less sustainable are things which try to cling on to the past, like Make America Great Again, for example. And so I think that broader definition of sustainability is really promising as an overarching narrative, if you like, for the next 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years.
I agree with you. As a matter of fact, it's listening to you makes me think that your ideas map very well to Maslow's hierarchy of need. And, you know, some of what you're talking about is kind of high up in the pyramid. What I've only talked about so far is the importance of things like fresh water, transportation, food.
There was a story today that that seems to dovetail with some of what you're saying, that you can approach a situation and you can be negative or positive about it, but that the blockchain can allow these things to be fixed, moved, and promised, and then delivered. And I'll do a big story on how journalism can take advantage of the blockchain and allow people to enter content into it and have it be approved. It's an effort to try and avoid fake news.
Okay, you're
it's like a self-approval process built into it. Does that make sense to anybody?
Well, yes.
It makes me wonder. It makes a lot of sense to me, Frank, and it makes me wonder if once Trump understands what blockchain really is, if he'll find a way to sabotage it, simply because he operates in an opaque universe and he's living in a government that thrives on transparency, and blockchain enhances transparency.
Well, the one thing that keeps sort of singing out to me is something that Dan said earlier, which is talking about whatever these specific issues are, that they're getting drowned in this sea of noise. So getting noise out of the system is what media's responsibility is. And right now, I don't see any leadership in this area. Dan, do you have a comment?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by leadership. I think there's a lot of leadership, and that many news organizations are doing a very good job of trying to provide factual information. But, you know, we're in an age where information is weaponized and people go to war with it. So it makes it much more difficult for people to discern what is truthful, what to believe. For people to open their minds and be cognizant of other points of view. So we're just at that stage. But, you know, going back to this talk about blockchain, whether it's blockchain, artificial intelligence, material science, CRISPR, and splicing DNA, I mean, there's so much technology innovation that we can't really predict how it's going to change things, but we do know there'll be fundamental changes over the next several decades based on just vast improvements in the technologies that we have today, just as we saw over the last 30 years. This could even be more accelerated. So while we little humans, you know, play our little games, our Game of Thrones and our game of politics and whatever else, at the same time, we're going to be faced with, you know, serious challenges culturally, politically, socially, economically, as these technologies really alter the landscape. Some of the issues now are, okay, well, what are the ethics around those technologies? Who owns the technologies? There's, for example, a race to be the first, you know, own a quantum computer or AI. There's recent stories about how the United States is losing its technological edge to China. And what does that mean? So everyone sees those in terms of who's winning and who's losing, unfortunately.
Well, I agree with everything you said, but I will take another stab at suggesting that the ability to be able to surround important information with wedge issues, and you know, this is what the Republican Party's been doing for years, and I would say so is the Democrat team as well. when something I'm frustrated by when I play the games of watching the political landscape shift, I get very frustrated on the left, if you will, MSNBC, with you know, a sort of rush by people as credible as Elizabeth, what is her last name? The senator?
Warren.
Thank you.
Warren.
Elizabeth Warren, she'll talk about an issue, but then she'll turn it into a discussion about the mechanics of Democratic wedge issues. And there's a certain rigidity to that that I think is gameable by the opposition. So we get this kind of sort of block, counter-block kind of thing going on where we all spend our time on the, you know, the latest news report and don't see or allow ourselves to see, you know, the strengths of the opposition. That's the one thing that I think that this election proved to us, and I don't think that we've taken the taken it to heart, which is that there are many people who we disagree with who nonetheless have very sincere feelings about what's going on and how to be able to turn it to their advantage for their themselves and their families and constituents. And I think that as long as we turn these discussions, and I'm not talking about this one in particular, but just turn our political attention to the things that have gotten people elected and have ended up in this kind of 50-50 split where nothing gets done, I think that we're making a big mistake.
I think you're right. You know, as I'm listening to you, it occurred to me that in this technological, information-driven age, one of the few things that hasn't been automated is anything substantial in politics. I mean, why don't we have automation for content analysis going simultaneously with people we're watching on TV and listening to?
Well, I'm not sure I understand what you specifically mean. Who is it who's writing the algorithms?
Well, I don't know. It's certainly not me. I think what I'm sort of angling for is we've got AI and machine learning to do all kinds of things, but when we start rating things with Pinocchio noses or Rotten Tomatoes, that's pretty much a manual task, and it takes a day to fact check a speech by or a set of pronouncements by Donald Trump, for example, to say, "Oh, this was a lie, that was a lie," and that might be true, but it's too late.
Actually, it's not too late.
Okay.
Because you know, he lies on average, you know, 5 times a day, and that's been going on for many months now. And that hasn't changed the fact that his base and the Republican Party still supports him. So it's more about, will people get out and vote in 2018?
That's right. And what do you think the answer is?
Well, I'm hoping yes. I mean,
I'm not asking about hope. What's your assessment? I mean, you're pretty astute. You used to run a news site. So, I mean, what do you think is going to happen? You think that the Democrats are going to take over the House in 2018?
I think that's likely, but uncertain. The Democratic Party needs to figure out how it can lead and not continually be on the defensive. Mm-hmm. It's difficult because Trump is kind of a master of distraction. And I think, at least I and many others, I think we've underestimated the power and perhaps even some of the size of the Trump nation. And I think I always thought that that there would be a, you know, at the end of the day, you have to have some kind of moral backbone. And what we've seen is that no longer exists in some parts of our political sphere. And that's quite disheartening, disappointing. The fact that someone like Roy Moore could get elected to the Senate of the United States in 2017 is disturbing. But that's our reality, and as a species, we seem to have gone backwards, and we'll just have to kind of get up and go again.
So, what I mean, it feels to me, Steve, to answer your question about the 2018, for there to be a massive turnout that will produce a big difference, there would have to be inspired leadership against Trump, probably from the Democrats, which at least right now doesn't seem to, at least for me, I'm not seeing it. I'm not hearing ideas and ways of explaining those ideas that are galvanizing and positive.
I think you're right. Yeah, the Democrats are not doing a good job of speaking their own truth. They're in total reactive mode, and that's a huge mistake. If that continues in 2018, then I think the Democrats are in for trouble.
You mean more trouble? Continued trouble.
And who would it be? I mean, you mentioned Elizabeth Warren earlier. It could be that I'm out of the country a lot and don't notice it, but she seems to have become invisible, as has Bernie, who did a great job in the election, I thought, the last election, of raising issues and trying to be optimistic and positive. I don't know who it would be that would be the person that would you would look to articulate some kind of vision.
Well, I think Al Franken was teeing up that role for himself, but look what happened to him.
Yep.
That's a problem. Maybe somebody like Cory Booker of New Jersey could fill that role. He gave a great speech at the Democratic Convention last year, and he's been pointed out as a potential rising star. It's still early. Elizabeth Warren is running for re-election, I think, in 18. So she needs to be focused on local political issues in Massachusetts and representing the state. She needs to nail down that office before she turns her sights to 2020. And she's got time for that. The issue right now is the midterm election next year.
Does America vote very locally in those midterms, or does it matter that there is no national voice or vision?
It's I think kind of local, and I think we usually see some fall off in turnout for the midterm elections. So getting high turnout is one of the hills that the Democrats will have to climb. Republicans may have a different hill to climb, which would be that they could be dispirited because of ongoing investigations and possible legal action against Trump.
And I think that certainly will be a national voice in those regional elections.
Agreed.
So how many people have or will be getting an iPhone X?
Have.
Two?
Have.
Okay.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, well, you know, Frank, you just got up your first iPhone the other week, right?
No, that's not true. I've had every single iPhone there is to have, and for some reason I went and bought the iPhone 8
exactly.
Plus. And my wife said, "Well, why don't you just wait until you buy the X?" And I went, "No, I want this right now." And that was, you know, just me being. I'll probably get one.
So Dan, what do you think?
I like it a lot.
Okay.
I think it's
fundamentally transformative of the way that I use computers.
Yeah, just because it just turns on when you want it to turn on without having to do anything.
Right, and it's there's a great article, which I'll put in the chat room, that describes how it understands whether, you know, you can set it so that it understands that you're looking at it as opposed to just, you know, being recognized by it. And so there's a whole definitional kind of software design that's going to emerge out of this, where they point out, which I hadn't noticed until they pointed it out, that if you, when you get close to the phone, you set an alarm and it's very loud to wake you up. But as you get close to it and react to it, when it sees that you're there, it lowers the volume. Now, if you think about, you know, all manner of decision making and group communications starting to take advantage of this to be less interruptive and more collaborative in terms of the signals that we're sending, and then those signals, a la what Amazon's doing with Alexa, etc., you start to see that this is going to transform the way that we use computers, you know, within the next 6 months. There was just an article that suggests that they're coming out with next year 3 of these phones with very large batteries. Yeah.
That's what I'm waiting for. There, I'm waiting for that.
So you got to do what I do, Frank, which is I will just demonstrate. Here is the one that my wife saw me buy, which is the 8 Plus, and here is the X, which has got Coinbase on it. And this one is getting sold on Amazon. This one is a keeper. And you'll get 85 to 90% of the value of this one on Amazon if you sell it.
Oh, all right.
So that speaks to your strategy. Are you going to sell it on Coinbase? What was the Coinbase mentioned about?
It just happened to be on the screen when I showed it.
So what does Coinbase do?
Coinbase lets you link your bank account and your credit card to Bitcoin and Ethereum and start moving money between the two.
And how's that going?
Depends on the day, but this week is unbelievable, actually. I mean,
unbelievable in that it went to 19,000 and then all the people that bought in on the way up are now underwater?
Well, you just got to have a longer term view. I mean, if you bought in this week, hopefully you didn't buy in to make a one day gain. A week from now, you're going to be looking pretty smart.
Well, I better buy a whole shitload of Amazon gift cards then, because that's how I've been buying my Bitcoin.
Oh, you can do that.
What does that mean? I don't understand.
That's just a way to buy Bitcoin. Whenever I've had to make a Bitcoin purchase, I've used Amazon gift cards to buy parts of Bitcoins to make those purchases, mm-hmm. as opposed to just loading up a wallet. Because I didn't, I just don't feel, you know, that, you know, I did not want to ride that wave up. And then I saw that wave go up, and then I watched it go from 19,000 to what, 15,000? And I breathed a big sigh of relief because I was tempted to jump in. Instead of doing it, I just bought the amount of Bitcoin I needed for the purchase that I needed to make. But
I'll tell you, my story is kind of, I got seasick about a week ago. I was in the UK and I do own some Bitcoin and it started going crazy and Coinbase and a bunch of exchanges went down. It was the day that the Chicago Board of whatever it is announced they were going to be doing futures contracts in Bitcoin. And suddenly it went from, I think it was like £7,000 to £9,000 in a day and it all crashed. And I was sitting on it and thinking, oh my God, this is an unrepeatable event. I better sell now at the top. So I sold all my Bitcoins. And then I woke up the next day, and it kept going up. And I'd missed out on, I don't know, $1,000 worth of gain, and said, damn, I shouldn't have sold. And I bought back in. And the thing is, if you try to follow the movements, you do it all wrong, because your emotions are the opposite of what's happening. So when it goes up, you think you should buy. When it goes down, you think you should sell. So the best thing to do is either don't do it at all, or just buy some and stick with it.
I think the idea of day trading bitcoins just seems like a it's like you're day trading stocks that are in a boiler room kind of a situation, that because they're so volatile. Maybe I'm just being too conservative in my view. I do think that it's important that you're in it, because it is a currency that is being used to allow you to make purchases. Then some companies are demanding that's the way you do it now. And I've experienced two or three of them now that said, no, this is how I want to sell my product. I'm only going to sell it using Bitcoin. And so I'm in because of that. But I don't think I'd ever want to day trade that stuff right now. Although I feel like, you know, it's like being in gold.
Yeah. Well, if you take the long view, you could go either way, but my personal point of view is Bitcoin as a store of value is becoming legitimate to many, many people. The fact that NASDAQ is opening up futures, two different Chicago boards are opening up futures, the Australian Stock Exchange just changed its entire ledger system to blockchain. It's legitimate, and it only represents, and I've said this before on the show, and I think I'm now right, somebody picked me up on this, but it's now about 1% of what's known as M1, which is coins and notes in circulation. It's going to be way more than 1%. So if you take a long view, you're probably in good shape. If you take a short view, you're going to get seasick.
All right, let me ask you.
Using Bitcoin to buy marijuana futures. That's it. That's the business.
Okay, so I was trying to get ahead of the latest Raddus joke, but I was too slow. Yeah, of course it's a joke. So here's how I would frame it. And I want to go around the table and ask everybody for their opinion of this. I have to choose. I've got $1,000. And I could spend it on, and this is my daughter's future. I could spend it on Bitcoin, or I could buy an iPhone X for her. Which is more important?
If she's happy with the iPhone X, I'd say the iPhone X for sure. But if it's an investment for her future, I'd say Bitcoin.
So if she's happy... as a metric for the importance of, I mean, she's very sophisticated technologically. She runs rings around us in terms of the way she uses, networks like Snap and, you know, just all sorts of stuff. She's very sophisticated. So if she took these proximity features, as somebody in the chat room suggests that we're talking about here, if she took them and somehow intuited something relating to a film that she's writing, or an approach to group formation in terms of friends that are on that network as opposed to other people who should be on that network, you know, which do you think is going to be more important to her, $1,000 in Bitcoin on any given day? That could be $0 if it crashes significantly, or if it goes up. Let's say that, you know, we're at the top right now is 19,000, but it's holding around 15,000. Let's say a year from now, is the bet that she's going to make on that $1,000, she's going to make a 5x improvement, she's going to make $4,000? Is that what she's going to do with that year of productivity versus $1,000 on an iPhone X? I know what my bet would be. What you suggest.
In the last 12 months, the gain on Bitcoin has been more like 4,000%. So let's assume it only does 10% of what it did in 2017, in 2018, then you're right, 1,000 goes to 4,000. And the answer to your question really is, how much does she value $3,000? If the answer is not very much, then the iPhone's by way the better choice, because it's going to enhance her.
I would answer that a little differently. How much does she value $3,000 right now, as opposed to a lifetime of a career that came out of an insight that she derived from
technology? No, you're completely
okay. So that
you're right. You're thinking about it in the right investment. Way, but it's almost a false question, because for most of us, what we really should be asking is, should we be allocating any of our assets to, let's just broadly say, blockchain and crypto? I am, and time-wise, I'm probably allocating about 10% of my time.
Yeah, but come on, you're also in this as a business, you're in this as a consultant, as an advisor, as an expert. There are all sorts of reasons why you're in this world. You're making a bet about the people.
No, but I chose to do that. I could have made different choices.
Yeah, but I'm not asking about a professional analysis here. I'm talking about the analysis of a parent, basically, and which is going to have more impact in her life. That's all. I'm not criticizing your choice. I'm just suggesting that it would be different than mine.
So I have three boys, right? I have three boys. Guess what this is?
All right. So you're saying yes. All right. Let's go to Dan Farber. What would you do?
I would do both.
So you double down on, you'd get $2,000.
Yeah. I would get a nice iPhone X, and I would start her on her investment journey, mostly so she could learn about blockchain.
And what would she learn?
It's always good, if you're investing, to kind of understand what you're investing in and how it works.
Well, this reminds me of like when I was in college, back in the 50s. Is anybody listening?
And, come on.
Thank you. Took a while. We used to go down to Washington and hang out with friends. And we had a bookie, and I would get, I put money on the football game we were going to watch, because it was much more interesting when, of course I was trying to deal with, the field goals to beat the spread, as opposed to the actual winner of the game. So it reminds me a little bit of that what would the $1,000 on Bitcoin do to educate her or to introduce her to the mechanics of the environment? Dan.
Well, actually,
I wanted to ask Dan.
Oh, sorry.
Well, she would, hopefully study how blockchain works and how this digital economy is going to work. And then you really know better how to invest or to trust, or you can find somebody who you can trust to do that for you. But just kind of saying, I'll throw some money into Bitcoin or some other currency, unless you have a sense of what you're doing, it's not always the best idea.
Okay. Keith, you were saying?
Actually, I was going to say something very similar, because I'm doing most of what I'm doing to learn, and I find that unless I do things, I don't really learn. I have to risk losing some money to get the fear in the right place, basically.
Can you buy blockchain to lose?
Sure. Yeah, you definitely can. There's a lot of fake ICOs out there.
No, I mean, can you place a bet on blockchain going down?
Once the futures contracts come up, I think you'll be able to do that. I don't know if E-Trade lets you trade futures, but if it does, you're going to be able to short futures.
All right, okay. Dennis?
Well, Steve, I don't have $1,000 to waste, so my...
I let it slide with Dan about the doubling the investment, but I want an answer.
Let me change the verb tense. If one has $1,000 and that is the choice, to me, the choice should be the phone, not the Bitcoin, because the phone will provide you with something tangible that you can derive value from, whereas the Bitcoin is a toss-up.
But, you know, the knock on the iPhone X is that it, you know, there are other Android devices which do just as well. I mean, what is the tangible value of it that is worth that as an investment? It seems to me that you're not recognizing my thesis, which is that it's transformative as a technology, and that it's to Dan's point about the blockchain investment, you're betting on the future as opposed to making do with you know, the present.
Okay, so actually, in both, it sounds like in both cases you're saying, I have $1,000 to invest in learning something about some futuristic technology or wrinkle in the world. Do I put it into Bitcoin or do I put it into the phone? Is that your question?
Well, I understood my question. I don't understand your question about my question. All right. I'll let you swirl around in that while I ask Frank's opinion.
I'm still buying the phone for my kid.
Excellent. The only correct answer. Go ahead, Frank.
Buy the phone.
Okay. So.
But Steve, if by doing that you close down the possibility that Bitcoin represents an interesting technology and personal future, then that would also be a mistake.
No, I think that what you do is you buy the phone, you write the script that for the movie that you then sell to use that money to buy the Bitcoin.
There you go.
I agree with that too. All right, so basically it's 5-0. In the chat room, Francine, of course, says that other than facial recognition, that iPhone X is not important, and the blockchain is truly transformational. So
Francine's missing one important thing about the iPhone X's Facebook recognition. It isn't just Facebook recognition, face recognition. It's the solution to single sign-on that has been pursued by every tech company in the Valley for the last 20 years. Suddenly, just by picking up your phone, you can log in to anything.
Well, my definition of a transformative technology is when I want everything else that precedes it to start working the same way. Like, yes. For example, this iPad. I don't want to have to keep poking at the home button in order to wake it up so that I can find out what's happened in the last minute and a half. I want it to know that I'm looking at it, and therefore I'd like it to be on. We just got a Nest... what is it?
Thermostat,
thank you. And I have no idea why that's going to be a good thing, but the best part of it is that I no longer have to go over and turn the heat up when my daughter texts me in the middle of the night to do so. She now has the app, and she can damn well do it herself. So that's transformative progress.
Or unless she has the Echo in her room, and she can tell the Echo to do it.
That's coming next, as soon as we figure out how to wire it up. All right, so this is all very, very optimistic until we start talking about Trump. And I would suggest that the information industries have to do some heavy lifting over the next 6 months if there's going to be any chance of what Dan predicts is going to be the possibility of the House flipping to the Democrats. I personally think that there's a small chance of the Senate being tipped, but almost none for the House. Anybody want to hazard a guess about that?
I think it's just the opposite. I think the House is more likely to flip than the Senate. The Democrats are defending an awful lot of seats. I forget how many, but There are a lot of Democrats up for re-election. I could see the Senate not flipping, but in the House, you need about 23, 25 seats to change hands.
I agree with that. I think it's the House.
And Keith, you don't know, right?
I have no effing clue.
Okay. Well, we're at the hour mark, so I want to start to wind down. Anything else that anybody wants to talk about?
Getting Prime.
Oh, that's the biggest news of the week for us. I have Prime on my Apple TV as of last night.
Yep.
It's fantastic.
It is. We're watching Trapped on it.
Sweet.
Well, we watched a film that from Amazon Studios. What was it called? Anyway, it was a good film, and it would never have been on. You would never have been able to see it on Apple TV, and now you have. The Only Living Boy in New York. It was Jeff Bridges. Excellent job.
And the good news is I can get rid of all my Fire TVs now. I don't need them anymore.
Well, we'll have to get Kevin Marks back on so that he can argue with you about that.
Yeah, I have three of them in my house, the Fire TVs now, and only one Apple TV, so I don't know what to do.
Okay, so that's all we want to talk about?
No, I want to talk about John Lennon.
What about him?
Today is the anniversary of when he was killed in 1980. And before we went on tonight, I had asked Steve if he remembered where he was that night. Because I had been reminded that I was in the ABC newsroom at 7 West 66th Street, which was just a few blocks away from the Dakota when the wire machines started going crazy. And all of us left the office and ran up the street and witnessed this scene that will forever be attached in my mind. And somebody today from that group posted a photograph of Chapman having an autograph signed by John Lennon moments before he shot him. So it just reminded me of that. That's all.
Well, I was, as I told you, I was in the band's studio in Malibu, Shangri-La, watching Monday Night Football when Howard Cosell came on and announced it. And something happened. I mean, obviously, I was extremely upset about this. I won't say who, but one of the people at the studio walked into the room and said, he was just a guitar player.
Huh.
And about a week later, I left the studio and went somewhere else.
Well, there you go.
But, you know, I understand his perspective. If you listen to some of the tapes of John Lennon just after the Beatles broke up, he was one angry dude. And he was not the enlightened John Lennon icon that we now see. He was an angry, very emotional. It felt like he had lost his. It felt like he was getting a divorce, which I guess he was.
You mean from life or from Yoko?
No, not from Yoko. From the Beatles.
From the Beatles, yeah.
Yeah, it was a. It wasn't an attractive side of John Lennon. He was vituperative and angry, and really didn't care that he was putting that stuff out. I think Yoko helped him to find a better side to his instincts over time. Mm. But I wasn't so charitable about Yoko in those years.
Well, I just thought it was worth remembering. That was really my point.
Dan, where were you? Do you remember it?
I really don't remember, but that's not uncommon.
Tina was in her dorm room. How about you guys? Keith?
Where was I when Lenin was killed? I think I was... what year was it?
80.
I was just at the end of my PhD, so I was probably in London. And I was very involved in politics, which Lenin was, of course, very political. And he shared in common two of my key issues, which was troops out of Ireland and the right to immigration. So emotionally, I was very close to him. I remember being amazingly shocked. It was like when Kennedy got killed, except more so because you felt like you knew Lenin more than you knew Kennedy if you were a Brit.
Yeah.
Dennis?
I was sitting at my kitchen table. The football game was on. I was reading a hematology textbook, and then I went out drinking.
Okay, well, thanks for bringing it up, Frank. I really mean that. I mean that. I mean it.
Okay.
It 37 years doesn't seem like a, you know, a media approved round number, but it still stings like it just happened.
Yeah.
It's worth remembering.
Well, I want to thank you. Here's a shout out to some friends of ours who are recuperating from surgery, and I hope everything went well. I want to thank NewTek and their TriCaster for helping us bring us together like this. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work as well, but in any case, this is a miracle of communications that we're lucky to be able to participate with. I want to thank Ustream. We use Ustream to record and stream the Gilmore Gang, as well as G3, which is coming up later at 4 p.m. And do you have Elisa on the show? Oh, good. So Elisa Camahort Page, who was on the show The Gang last week, is gone back to her day job at G3, so I'm going to be tuning into that. I want to thank our producer and director, Tina Chase Gilmore. I want to thank Dan Farber for reappearing. I know how busy you are, and just appreciate your perspective. It's
always good to be with you.
Well, I follow your tweet stream is more informative than any major news organization, as far as I'm concerned.
I'm a little biased.
Yeah, that's why I like it. I want to thank Dennis Pombriant.
Thanks, Steve. It's always a pleasure.
Likewise. Keith Tier, welcome back.
It's a pleasure to be back. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a great thing. And we kept the blockchain IANA to a relatively stable amount.
You know, there was requests in the chat for me to talk about an ICO I'm involved in, and I resisted. You'd be very pleased to hear.
Well, I would have just muted you. Don't worry about it. And Frank Raddus, we didn't get to talk about all this amazing stuff that's going on, but in the world of television and media, but it is moving very fast. Your new next normal is already old news.
Yeah, it's now the new next normal. And I just got asked to speak at another Digital Hollywood about that. And I said, I was asked to pull together the group to talk about the new next normal. And this is for a conference in March. And I said, I think it's preemptive to book that now, because I think things are changing so fast that it may just be that we're booking the wrong people. And but I want to thank you and for bringing this gang together. It was great tonight. Thanks a lot, and great to see all you guys.
As he tries to wrap it up, as though it was the Raddus Gang, but that's all right. Speaking of other shows. there's a tweet that Keith did of about a lecture or a slide deck with audio that Benedict Evans did, which is truly extraordinary, as Keith indicated it with some degree of obscenity on Twitter. But it's really extraordinary. If you could put that in the chat room, that'd be great. And we'll, it's in the app for those of you who are testing the Gilmore Gang app. It's what, about 23 minutes?
Yeah.
How does a guy think that fast for so long?
It's an hour and a half's worth of content in 23 minutes.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. He basically just says what's going to happen for the next two decades. But interestingly, if you go through the whole thing and listen, basically, blockchain's going to happen. That's all he really said. But I think that Dan's right that AI is going to happen. Blockchain's going to happen. The iPhone X is going to happen. Things are moving pretty well. And if we can just remember that while our blood pressure rises about the idiot who's in the White House, we'll be okay. Thanks to everybody who showed up. The chat room, as usual. I'm being applauded by a dog. There's an animoji. What is that?
It's a GIF.
It's a GIF. It's an anim. GIF anim.
Animated GIF. It's Thank amazing. You. I didn't even know Chat Center supported animated GIFs, and I am its author. So there you go.
Thanks to everybody who showed up, and especially those who didn't. We'll see you again next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.